Okay, good morning everyone, and welcome to ITE Module 1, Part B, or Part 2. We got about halfway last week. I've just got to catch up and get some notes here, so I'm going to let Kerry start from where we were, which was on RAM and ROM. So I'll hand over to Kerry.
Okay, we're going to talk about the two types of memory. Now, I'd be interested to know, and somebody let us know on chat at some point, Geraldine is breaking up minorly every 10 to 15 seconds. Let me know if the same thing happens to me so that I can figure out whether it's an internet problem or a problem with the Kinexant audio that is badly supported under Windows XP. Okay. Now, and I didn't even take my own advice and go and install eSpeak for my chat session. No, I'm talking about RAM and ROM. They're certainly not primary and secondary. You'll find that primary and secondary are types of storage. RAM and ROM. RAM stands for Random Access Memory. There are two types of RAM. One is SDRAM. One is DRAM, I should say, and the other one is SRAM. DRAM is dynamic random access memory, and SRAM is static random access memory. DRAM is a series of capacitors which is charged up to store information, and SRAM, I believe, according to one of our students, uses flip-flops. I haven't actually looked into that. However, static SRAM will actually retain the information whilst power is applied and does not need to be refreshed. DRAM needs to be refreshed, and in fact most computers refresh DRAM every 15 microseconds. Okay, we have somebody with an open microphone.
That's me. I've just
You're in AutoVox. Yep.
Yes. And I've caught up to you, Kerry, when you're ready. So you can finish on RAM.
Yep, I think, and ROM is read-only memory, which is memory that is usually slower than RAM, and it is usually used for BIOS chips and things where you don't need to change it very often. You have a number of forms of ROM. You've got the raw form of ROM. You've then got EEPROM, which is erasable by using an ultraviolet light or by leaving it in the sun. And then you've got EEPROM, or E-squared PROM, which is electrically erasable programmable read-only memory, which is where you put 12 volts onto one of the program pins and then you can actually clear it off and reprogram it. This is also often referred to as flash memory. And that's all good. I think we're going to have to drop your sensitivity down, Geraldine, because it's opening up whenever you even wave near the microphone.
Breathe. Would you like me to stop breathing?
Yes, that'd be good.
Oh, jeez, you don't want to stand for that, do you?
Okay, I'll just go in and do that. Okay.
Any questions on RAM and ROM before we continue?
And I'm on 40 now, so we'll see how we go. I think they're all happy with RAM and ROM. Okay, thanks, Kerry. We have caught up again now. All right, so some of the components that we're going to talk about within your computer are components called adapter cards. And basically what they do is they increase the functionality of the computer. They've got controllers for the devices. There are a number of them that you're going to come across. First that I'd like to talk about is the NIC, or the NIC. Anyone want to tell me what that stands for?
Network Interface Card.
We have a question
Network
here.
Network Interface Card.
That's correct.
We have a question here that says which one's used more commonly. DRAM is used more commonly because SRAM is hell expensive.
All right.
Okay, so that's correct for those that said the network interface card, and that actually connects your computer, as it sounds, to the network. Okay, it's connected via a network cable. You also have a wireless network interface card, and that, as it sounds, it connects to the computer to your network, and it does that via wireless or radio frequencies. You've got things like your sound adapter, so that's as it sounds, gives you audio capability, your video adapter, which gives you the graphical capabilities, your modem, which connects your computer to the internet using the phone line, your SCSI adapter, and that is an SCSI, but it's pronounced SCSI, and it connects your SCSI devices, things like your hard drive or a tape drive to the computer. You also have a RAID adapter, and that connects multiple hard drives to your computer, and that allows redundancy, so you get better performance. You've got USB port, where you'll use those to connect the peripheral devices. Extra things, like today I've got my USB port that's got a Brailleant connected to it, so I can access my notes. Remember where I'm up to, hopefully. parallel ports, which again are for connecting your peripheral devices, and your serial port, which again is another method of connecting your computer to extra devices. There's also a number of expansion slots on your system board that allow you to connect those adapter cards. For those that have actually pulled computers apart, you'll obviously have come across all these components. For those that haven't, we actually have a recording of a lot of this on the QCAT website. Yeah, that's right, Alex. And so you can actually go and listen to us sort of destroying a computer and then building it up again. We had a lot of fun doing that, didn't we, Kerry?
We did indeed.
Okay. The type of adapter card connector needs to match the slot or the expansion slot that goes in. Also, things like riser cards are used, and they allow the adapter card just to be installed horizontally. Usually the riser cards are in their more slimline type desktop computers. And you will come across, well, particularly our local students should be actually feeling these devices and actually pulling a computer apart in the next week or two. So we'll have loads of fun doing that. But for those that haven't got access to pulling a computer apart, if you can go and have a listen to the recording that we did last year or the year before. Time flies, I can't remember now, but I think it might have been
there's
the year before
one for
that we
each.
Actually did it. Oh, we did one last year too, that's right. Okay.
Yep. Yes? Can you put your name in if you're asking a question? Yeah, all right, it's Alex. We figured out who you are now, but if you're not here, put your name in so that we know who's asking the question. When we are talking riser cards, we are talking to a card that plugs into the motherboard at 90 degrees to the plane of the motherboard and then has other cards plugging into the riser card. They are called, he's asking, what do you call it if you've got a board that supports four USB ports and via cable and you plug the cable into the board? They are called headers, and you plug the cable into the headers and then you just screw the cable into the back plate or wherever you jam them out the front of the case. There's no special funky name for them.
Was there any other questions on that just before we move on? All right. Some of our other components, internal components of a computer, things like storage drives, they are things that actually read or write your information, and that can be to magnetic or it can be optical storage media. You can have it stored permanently, or you can be using types of storage media that you're rewriting over from time to time. Things like floppy drives, not so commonly used as much these days, but they're a storage device that uses 3.5-inch floppy disks. They can store up to about 1.44 meg of data. It's usually, when you're talking in configuring the floppy drive in computers, it's usually allocated to the A drive. The older floppy disks used to be about 5.25-inch, I believe. Not seen very much these days, I wouldn't think. Okay, you've also got your hard drive, and that's a magnetic storage device, and that's installed in your computer. It's used for permanent storage of data. and it's usually configured as C drive or C colon. It's got your operating system installed on it, and all of the applications that you have installed are actually installed on the hard drive. Storage capacity, well, that's changing all the time, but it's measured in actually billions of bytes or gigabytes. So when we talk a gig, we're talking about a gigabyte. The speed of your hard drive is measured in the RPM, which, anyone want to tell me what that stands for?
Rates per minute.
Yeah, revolutions per minute. Yeah, that's a good one. Okay. Yeah, revolutions per minute is RPM. You can also have more than one hard drive. You can have a number of hard drives, and that's going to give you, obviously, increased capacity. As I mentioned, there is optical storage media as well, and things like your compact disc, your CD, or your DVD. Anyone want to tell me what a DVD stands for?
Digital video disc?
No.
Yes, we did get... Yeah, we got a couple of people said digital versatile disc.
Digital versatile disc.
That's correct, yeah. So for everyone who got that, well done.
A lot okay. of people think it is digital video disc because most people see video on DVDs, and that was the first use of the high-volume media. However, digital versatile disc is what they officially call them because they can actually store more than video. So there you go.
Yeah, your DVDs can usually have about 8.5 gig on one side of your disc, and there are a number of different types of optical media. Anyone want to tell me some of the different types of CDs that you can get, or DVDs? Yeah, rewritable. Yeah, there's a
CDR and CDRW we have, yeah.
Yep, getting a few here.
Yeah, and you can get ROMs.
CD-ROM, yep,
yep, DVD
that's
and
right.
CD-ROM, yep.
Yep.
One more for DVD. Nah, here's your cryptic clue. There we are.
DVD pig?
No, RAM.
Oh dear. Chaos reigns supreme here. Okay, yeah, that's good, everyone. All right, flash drives is another way we can store our data. A few names that people use for those. Go for it, guys. Tell me a few of the names that people call them. Thumb drives. Yeah, thumb drives. Yep. Yep, yep, there's a whole number of names that people give to those here. Yep, that's right, yeah. You get a whole range of different names. And it's just a small removable storage device, and it connects into your USB port.
USB thingy, yep, that's definitely what we call them.
Yeah. US, highly technical USB thingy, yeah, that's right. Okay, and, you know, but once upon a time they were, you know, you thought a 4 gig flash drive was really, really powerful, and now they're...
Hey, hang on, our first one was 128 meg.
Yeah, I was just thinking that too, Kerry.
No, I was just thinking, I saw one the other day, it was like 32 gigs. They're getting sort of... a lot more capacity on them now.
Although one of the things that people, flash drives are very convenient and handy dandy. However, one of the things that if you actually do the...
Until you lose them
or run your office chair over them, yeah. or step on them. But you actually get some... flash actually works out at about $5 a gig, so it's not actually that cheap. And in fact, you can get a 320 gig hard drive for $120, which is about 37 cents a gig. So it's often more effective to have a removable portable pocket drive than it is to actually have a flash drive. So, be careful how big you get your flash drive, because when a 32 gig flash drive gets stamped on or stolen by the kids, you've lost a lot of data. So, and also look at the pricing of them, because the higher capacity ones do tend to be more expensive. The sweet spot at the moment is around about 4 to 8 gig. They start going up from there, maybe 16, but the 32s you certainly pay a premium for. Also, the write speed on flash drives is slow, and I say this every year, and I'm going to say it again because it's now 2009. Do not save your Word document onto the flash drive, close Word, and then immediately rip your flash drive out of your machine. The data's not going to be on there. Neither will your Word document. Make sure you use the safely remove hardware icon in the system tray that everybody seems to forget about. If you rip your flash drive out and it goes de-dunk, you haven't safely removed it. What happens if you don't safely remove your flash drive? 99% of the time, absolutely nothing, and you'll get away with it. But on the 1%, when something's really, really important and there's a job interview sailing on whether you've got the data or not, it will irrevocably scramble your flash drive, corrupting the file allocation table, and you'll have to reformat the whole thing and lose all the stuff you carefully stashed on it. So there you go. Safely remove. Always a good idea.
Interestingly, I was at Officeworks last week.
We'll get back to that in a minute. Go on, Geraldine.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say, I was at Officeworks the other day and they had small pocket drives, as Kerry's talking about, you know, with much larger capacity. 160 gig one there for $59. Not bad.
And to answer your question, why is viruses on flash drives more than hard drives? That's because Windows has brain-dead defaults and has auto-run enabled by default. So every single virus that spreads around knows how to use auto-run on any sort of removable media to bounce itself to and from every single person's flash drive that has the misfortune of being plugged into that USB port. If you know what's good for you and you have control of your computer, turn auto-run off.
Yes, and we saw that back here in January, a few friends of yours and myself in Melbourne, Kerry. So we've seen it happen.
Now, there's been another breakout of the viruses as well. They're all over lots of flash drives. In fact, one of the curtain technicians that left his flash drive in a computer and got picked up by a friend of mine, which is what happens to you if you leave your flash drive somewhere. You don't always get them back. It actually had a virus on it. And AVG sort of came up and screamed and carried on. And that auto run is actually extremely dangerous. And there are methods of turning it off. I think there's an article in Windows Secrets that I would have to dig up. But turning auto run off is a damn good idea, especially on removable media, because you do not want a virus automatically running as soon as you plug it in. It's not cool at all.
No, not too good at all. Yeah, so there are good things with having these smaller types of flash drives, you know, but also, you know, be a bit wary, and they're terribly easy to lose. I actually came across one on the train the other day on the seat next to me, and, you know, you just sort of got a lot of things that are very personal to you there too, so, you know, be a bit careful.
What did you do?
I actually picked it up and I took it to the office at the station. I thought somebody might go looking for it, yeah.
Good on you.
Here's another concept. When you have your flash drive, set the volume label on the flash drive to your name. That way we'll know who owns it, or something that is, you know, relevant to you. If I pick up a flash drive that's called Tiger, I'll know that it belongs to my wife.
I was thinking of putting my phone number in a text file or something.
Well, yeah, but then you might get a lot of people for a good time call. Possibly your Gmail address is a better idea. I mean, they might get a good time if they call, but still, you don't want strange people sort of.
Oh dear. Okay. So, your hard drives, yes, go on.
What about solid-state drives? That's something that seems to be popping up every now and then now. What are those all about?
Oh, that's just a flash drive jammed in something that looks like a hard drive. Yawn. They use up less power. They don't have any moving parts. but you're looking at about $300 for 16 gig.
They're very expensive, yeah.
I've just had a question that said, aren't they just a whole lot of flash chips put in a line? No, it's a little bit more complicated than that. There is actually circuitry inside them that actually does what we call wear leveling, and you can look up wear leveling on Wikipedia. But essentially, flash has a finite number of write cycles, anywhere from 10,000 to 300,000 to 3 million. And what wear leveling does is at the block level of the flash device, it distributes the writes across the different blocks in the device so that the device wears out evenly, which is why all of those EEPC 701s haven't died in 3 months from having a 4 gig solid state drive. No, a solid-state drive is not the same as an external CD.
I was just going to pass that one on.
Mm. Yeah, and no, it's not the same as an external hard disk at all. And in fact, there are some BIOSes that will not boot from USB flash drives. However, they'll boot from USB floppies, and some of them will boot from external hard drives. The fundamental difference between a flash drive and an external hard disk is, generally speaking, an external hard disk has a partition table, master boot record, and boot sector, whereas flash drives are generally formatted without a partition table. You can actually put a partition table on a flash... you can actually put a partition table on a flash drive, but it's not generally done unless you're a power user. No, there's no difference between a flash drive and a pen drive.
It's just one of those many names they have, you know, that we were talking about before. Mm. Any other questions before we move on? Okay. Okay, so your hard drive and optical drive are both manufactured with different interfaces.
Solid-state drives have got flash chips in them. External hard drives have got hard disks in them. It's that simple. In other words, an external hard drive has spinning disks and heads and servo motors, and a solid-state drive has chips and electronic glue logic.
Okay.
And it's all back to your old age.
No problems. Oh, am I keeping you awake, Kerry?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. I've sent him to sleep on many occasions, folks.
I've sent her to sleep on many occasions, too.
Oh, we like to return the favour, don't we? Okay, so your hard drive and your optical drive, they're manufactured with different interfaces, and that those interfaces are used to connect the drive to the computer. So when you're actually installing a storage drive in a computer, you need to make sure that the connection interface on the drive is the same as the controller that's on your system board. Some of the different types of, or more common types of interfaces, that drive interfaces you'll come across, are the IDE. Anyone want to tell me what that stands for?
Me.
No, not you.
Oh! Gemma, you should know what it stands for.
I'm racking my brains here.
What's that?
IDE.
What does IDE stand for?
Something rather digital interface, isn't it? I can look it up.
No, you're all making it up.
No.
Integrated drive electronics.
Electronics, yeah.
I got as far as the integrated.
Oh, that's
someone
all right.
Here said, that's it. They suddenly know. And it's also
referred to as... Some of those things you just take for granted.
Yeah. And you don't sort of think about the full name all the time, you know.
Exactly, you just take for granted that it's IDE, and yeah.
Advanced technology attachment, and it's an early drive control interface, and it connects your computer to hard drives. And it's connected via a 40-pin connector. Another one is the EIDE. Anyone want to have a go at that one?
Extended integrated drive electronics?
No.
Not quite. Not quite. It is enhanced, yeah. also referred to as ATA2, and it's just an updated version of the IDE controller.
Which actually supports PIO modes greater than 2, and it also supports Ultra DMA modes 3 through 7. And especially with the UDMA 66 drives, you actually have a 40-pin connector and an 80-wire cable so that you can balance the interference across two of the wires per pin, which makes the cable more resistant to errors. Also, enhanced IDE adds CRC error checking on the data transfers across the IDE bus. There we go, more than you ever wanted to know, but what else am I here for?
Oh, your pretty face. I'm waiting for a bite and you didn't.
No, that's all right.
Well, you look all right to me, Kerry.
There you go. You got your bite.
Okay. So another one is PATA, P-A-T-A, and that's a parallel ATA. And it just refers to the parallel version of the ATA drive controller interface. SATA is another one. A lot of people will have heard of that. And that stands for serial ATA. So it's the serial version of the ATA drive. It uses a 7-pin connector. And we talked briefly about SCSI, S-C-S-I. Anyone want to tell me what SCSI stands for?
I was just going to throw an exam tip up here. It's a 7-pin cable, the SATA cable. It's a 7-pin cable. It's got 7 pins. The cable has 7 pins. It has 7 pins. It's in your exam. It's got 7 pins, okay? SATA's got 7 pins.
Was that 6 pins, Kerry?
No, it was 7.
7 pins. 7 pins. Okay. That's well, close. It's actually small computer
small
system
computer
interface. That's correct, yeah. And it can connect actually up to 15 drives, and they can be internal or external drives, and it uses a 50, 68, or a 80-pin connector for your SCSI.
And just out of morbid curiosity, the reason it uses so many pins, and I know nobody really cares, but here you go, is you've actually got one signal ground, one signal wire and one ground wire. So, for example, for 50-pin SCSI, we have 8 data wires and 8 ground wires. And because you've got a data wire and a ground wire, you've got what's called a balanced circuit. And a balanced circuit is a circuit where you can actually compare the interference on the two wires and things and eliminate noise off the bus, which increases the length of cable runs. Okay, I'm done now.
Not a problem. Any questions up to there? Okay, so we've talked about a number of components. When we're talking about the different drives, when you're installing them in the computer, they're going to require both a power cable and a data cable. So with a power supply, you're going to have a SATA power connector for the SATA drives. You'd have a Molex power connector for your PATA drives, and a Berg 4-pin connector for your floppy drive. That is a Berg 4-pin connector for the floppy drive. Berg 4-pin connector for your floppy drive. That'll also
That's in your
come
exam.
Up. It's in your exam. We do try and help you out here, folks. So, you know.
I would like to know one thing. Sorry for interruption.
No, that's okay. Go on.
I would like to know one thing. What is the difference in performance between SATA and IDE?
You'd only like to know one thing. That'll be a first for a student. No, I'm just having a joke with you. Generally speaking, the signalling speeds are higher on SATA. You're talking 3 megabits per second. 300 megabits per second, I think. 150 and 300 megabits per second, that's right. However, the actual platter to interface speeds are about comparable. So unless you get some really fast 10,000 RPM drives or some very high performance 7,200 RPM drives, you're not going to notice a huge performance increase between SATA and EIDE.
Okay, so are you hearing me okay? I've just adjusted my sensitivity a bit more.
You're always very sensitive, Geraldine.
Just a sensitive, caring gal. Okay, the data cables connect the drives to your drive controller, and that's connected to the hip bone. The hip bone's connected to the thigh bone. And that's located on your adapter card or on your system board. Okay. I can't help myself. I'm sorry. I have to sing.
Is this where I break into, can't help myself, bad habits?
Bad habits. That's it. Okay, with your floppy disk drive, the data cable has up to two 34-pin drive connectors and a one 34-pin connector for your drive controller. For your PADA IDE or EIDE 40 conductor data cable, the interface originally supported two devices on a single controller. But when you got to extended IDE, you had two controllers, and they were then capable of supporting two devices, and they use a 40-pin connector and a 40-conductor ribbon cable.
Can anybody tell me what are the two devices called if you have two devices on an IDE cable?
Master and slave.
Master and slave, that's exactly right. Apparently it's mistress and slave in Jenny's house. I wouldn't know. Now, primary and secondary, which is the answer I got from the other side of the room.
I could teach you.
Oh, no thank you, madam. Primary and secondary, let's step back into IT where it's safe here. Primary and secondary refer to the two different controllers, although you can actually have up to eight IDE controllers in a system, and then you've got primary, secondary, tertiary, etc. So that's the first and second IDE controller. And of course, lots of system boards have four or six or eight SATA interfaces. So, but you can only have one drive per SATA interface unless you are using a port multiplier. Okay, back to Geraldine.
Go on. I was waiting for that. Okay, so the PATA or EIDE is an 80 conductor cable, and it's used for transmitting data at 33.3 megabits per second and over and above that. The connectors that are used are still of the 40-pin variety. The SATA data cable has got seven conductors, one keyed controller for the drive, and one keyed connector for the drive controller. The SCSI data cable, and there's actually three types of SCSI data cables. You've got a narrow SCSI data cable, and that's got 50 conductors. Also has up to seven 50-pin connectors for the drive, and one 50-pin connector for the drive controller. It's also referred to as the host adapter. You also have a wide SCSI data cable that has 68 conductors and up to 15 68-pin connectors for your drives. Also has another 68-pin connector for the host adapter. You also have an ALT4 SCSI data cable which has 80 conductors, up to 15-inch 80-pin connectors for your drives, and you also have an 80-pin connector for the host adapter. Just as a point of interest, and I will reiterate this, a coloured stripe on a cable identifies pin 1. That is a coloured stripe on the cable. That identifies a pin 1. Okay? Don't forget that, because it's in your exams, all right? I can guarantee that one. Did someone have a question there?
No, Jenny was just making a noise.
What else is new? Okay, now we want to talk about the different ports on the computer, and also some of those characteristics of both ports and also cables. Your I.O. Ports, which I.O. stands for input-output, connect your peripheral devices, things like your printer, scanners, all those types of things. The serial ports and cables, they can be either a DB9, which is just the name that we give to the connection area of the connector, or a DB25 male connector. With serial ports, they transmit one bit of data at a time. Anyone tell us what a bit is? A bit of data?
That's the binary digit.
It was one binary digit. You were at Wednesday's lecture, weren't you?
That's well done. Okay, so a serial cable has a maximum length of 50 feet in the old money, or 15.2 metres. For our Americans on board, you're still in feet and inches over there, aren't you?
We sure are.
Okay, no problem. I can relate to both because I'm old enough to remember.
And I can do the same because my parents always used to tell me that things were 2 yards away and 6 yards away, and then when I got into school, everybody started talking in centimetres and metres, and I'm just like, what the?
I had the same problem.
Yeah. Okay, your USB serial bus, it's the universal serial bus, which stands for USB, and it's a standard interface that allows you to connect peripheral devices to your computer. It's originally designed to...
How many? I'm asking the students, how many devices can we connect on a USB? Yes, that's correct. 127.
They are US devices are what we call hot swappable.
Never tried.
Anyone know what that means?
You can plug them in and unplug them while the computer is on.
That's correct. While it's powered on, that's exactly right. And we like lots of these USB ports on our computer because we, can't have too many. But if you haven't got many, you can actually use a little hub. I'm sure most of you have seen or used them, but they have one connection that goes into the USB port, and then you've got a number of ports on a small hub that's external to that, so you can plug in more devices. USB 2 is the general standard we sort of see now. It allows transmission speeds of up to 480 megabits per second. They can only actually transfer data up to the maximum speed that's actually allowed by the port, however.
And here's an interesting point. Unless you have a specially designed hub, if you plug in USB 1.1 and 2.0 devices into a hub, most hubs will pull all of the ports down to USB 1.1 speeds. We found that out the hard way. So, segregate all of your USB 1.1 devices onto their own hub and all of their USB 2 devices onto their own hub, unless you go and buy a big funky hub that actually can standardly negotiate the different speeds.
Well, it was actually the $50 7-port D-Link hub that wouldn't do it, which really shocked me, because, we've had like 4-port cheap shockers that have done both speeds.
Well, you did say the key word in here, D-Link. Go ahead, Grace.
We have a crappy little hub that we just got, and I think that might be our problem. We have a scanner and another USB device hooked in, and it's not working, so that might be just what the problem is.
Also, some of the little flat, skinny scanners that everybody loves, like the Canon Lide 20 and Lide 30, those ones that you can supposedly chuck in your backpack that are USB-powered, draw a hell of a lot of power off the USB, and if you don't power the hub, you won't have enough to run the lamp in the scanner. So there you go. And the other problem with those little skinny flat scanners, which I would personally take out and stamp on, is that you've got to have the pages so close to the scanner glass because they're actually a contact image sensor. They've only got a very dim LED to actually light up the stuff you're scanning. So you can go and buy some of those little light, cheap, thin, skinny scanners. I personally wouldn't because they don't scan very well and they require a hell of a lot of power from the USB, which a lot of laptops cannot provide. Yeah, we go back to you now, Geraldine, I think.
That's okay. All right, FireWire. Lots of confusion generally with FireWire. Anyone want to tell me what it is?
It's kind of like USB, but it's proprietary and it goes a lot faster.
Ooh, no. It's actually faster than USB 1 and slower than USB 2. FireWire is actually slower than USB 2. It runs at 400 megabits per second. However, it has the advantage of supporting what we call isochronous or real-time data transfer, and it's often used on digital camcorders and video cameras and stuff. And it used to be used on Apples, but guess what? They've dropped FireWire off all of their recent MacBooks because nobody cares about it much anymore. FireWire is actually a trademark of Apple, which is why everybody else calls it iLink, or IEEE 1394. So Apple's trademarked the term FireWire, but there are two other names for it. There is FireWire 1 and FireWire 2. FireWire 1 runs at 400 megabits per second, and FireWire 2 runs at 800 megabits per second. My MacBook Pro does have a FireWire 2 port on it, but interestingly, new MacBooks do not have any FireWire at all. However, MacBook Pros do retain a FireWire 800 port.
Grace, yes.
Oh, okay, so I'm confused. You just said that the 1 goes at 400 and the 2 goes at 800. So the 2 is faster than USB, isn't it?
The FireWire 800 is faster than USB 2.0, but it only came out after these notes were printed.
Okay then, because I just knew that it was faster, and so I got really confused.
but FireWire 800 has a completely different plug, and you cannot plug FireWire 400 devices into a FireWire 800 port.
Nobody uses it.
Yeah, I haven't seen a lot of FireWire 800 gear. It is out there, but it's very rare. So generally speaking, the FireWire you're likely to see on your computers, unless you've got some pretty funky ones, which I know that Grace does have, but not all computers even have FireWire 800 on it, so technically your FireWire will be slower than your USB 2. USB 3 is out now, and it's actually a few gigabits. Now, what were you going to say, Gemma? You had a Gemma typed into chat there.
Actually, on motherboard specs, you see IEEE 1394A. What's that about?
I think they're the names of the ports. They're like USB A and B ports, I think. I'd have to check that.
Oh, I seem to recall seeing that in specs for motherboards, so there must be a difference between 1394 and 1394A. It's not something I've thought about.
The difference that I know of with those two is IEEE 1394A supports your data rates up to 400 megabits per second, use a 6-pin connector or a 4. IEEE 1394B, you've got a greater range of connections, and it gives you the capacity to use Cat5, UTP and optical fibre. Also, depending on the type of media you're using, data rates are greater. They're up to 3.2 gigabits per second over a 100 metre distance. That's, yeah, sort of just a difference in the standard, I believe, but I could be wrong too.
That's the good thing about standards. There's so many standards to choose from.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Okay, we shall move on. The parallel ports on your computer is a standard type of ADB25 uses a DB25 female connector. The parallel connector on your printer is a standard type B36 pin Centronics connector, and some of the newer printers can use a type C, which is a high density 36 pin connector. Your parallel ports can transmit 8 bits of data at a time, and it uses the IEEE 1284 standard.
I disagree with the notes there, but if the test says it does, then definitely put down that it does. The IEEE 1284 standard is actually the standard that is responsible for status readback and is not implemented on older printers. That's the one where you plug your printer in and Windows says you've just connected a Canon Shocker Jet up and you go and find the drivers. 1284 is actually...
Canon Shocker Jet.
the standards are... The 1284 standard is actually responsible for bidirectional transfer and status readback. But if the notes say that parallel uses IEEE 1284, you say that in the exam.
That's what you put. Yeah, exactly. Okay, your SCSI ports can actually transmit data at rates greater than 320 megabits per second, and they can support up to 15 devices. Okay, the SCSI port can be one of three different types, and there's a number of different connectors, the 50-pin, 68, or the 80-pin connected. Now, your SCSI device needs to be terminated at the endpoints of the SCSI chain. That is at the endpoint of the SCSI chain, at the endpoint of the SCSI chain, okay?
And the SCSI chain must be terminated at both ends.
Both ends. Yeah.
So if you have a card with just external devices only, you terminate on the card and on the last external device. And if you have internal devices only, you terminate on the last internal device and the card. And if you have internal and external devices, you terminate on the last internal device and the last external device. You do not terminate on the card. I've seen that happen a lot. And if you put more than two terminators on a SCSI, it will be hasta la vista, little SCSI bus, okay? I had to use that joke at least once this year.
You will be terminated. Okay. So that's in your exam too. We're very good to you guys. Okay. Alright, your network port is also known as your RJ45 port. It's known as that because you plug in an RJ45 connector for your network cable. And the connection speeds depend on the type of network port you've got. Standard Ethernet's going to transfer up to 10 megabits per second. Anyone know how much fast Ethernet can transmit?
You can get 100 megabits per second in 1 gig, can't you?
That's 100 for your fast Ethernet, and your gigabit Ethernet's got up to 1,000 megabits per second or gigabit. That's right. Good.
Well, if you unplug your scanner in the middle of running Quartzvile or your Twain application and your machine crashes and burns, we won't have any sympathy for you. And in fact, if you actually unplug a scanner while the Twain source is accessing it, you're likely to get a blue screen. I've actually seen people do it. It's quite spectacular. So whilst you may not have to safely remove the USB scanner, you do have to make sure the Twain source is closed.
Otherwise, never the Twain shall meet.
I was waiting for that.
Okay. The maximum length you can use for a network cable is 328 feet. That's one heck of a long network cable. Or 100 metres. Okay. Okay, your PS2 port connects a keyboard or a mouse to a computer. It's a...
What, a PS2 port nice. That was that long? No, I assume you meant a network cable.
Network cable.
Yes.
Yeah. That's a long, long network cable. Okay. The PS2 port is a 6-pin mini DIN female connector. And the connectors you actually get for your keyboard and mouse are usually got different colours so you can identify them. Not so good for us, but for sighted people. There is also a small figure that's next to the port too, tells you which one goes in there, so for sighted people. Makes
okay.
it easy.
I'm going to break every OH&S rule in the book, but if you have sensitive fingers, you can often feel the icons that represent the keyboard and the mouse, or if your fingernails are not up, fingers aren't up to the task, you can use your tongue. However, make sure that no power is applied to the other end of the cables if you're going to stick them near your mouth. And the keyboard one, speak for yourself, the keyboard one looks like a crosshatch and the mouse one doesn't. And you can often also do that with the symbols on headsets for keyboards and microphones.
We just got a question here in the classroom, folks. It won't be a second.
Okay, Alex is saying that usually the keyboards go in the right-hand side and the mouses go in the left side. Generally, except for when it's not, has been my experience. In fact, I've got some compacts that do it the other way around, and I've got some desktop cases that have the keyboard on the top and the mouse on the bottom when they should have the mouse on the bottom and the keyboard on the top. So it's a good rule of thumb to work towards, but it's not always the case, but it will get you out of trouble a lot of the time. Generally, you won't blow up a keyboard if you plug it into the mouse port, or a mouse if you plug it into the keyboard port, although obviously your keyboard and mouse won't work. Do not plug in keyboards and mice into PS2 ports on desktop computers when the machine is powered up. I have seen people blow up motherboards doing it, so it's not going to be all right.
Okay, your audio ports, as they sound, connect your audio devices to your computer. You've got your line in, which gives you external source, things like your stereo system, that. Microphone, as it sounds, connects your microphone. Your line out connects things like your speakers or your headset that you're using. You've also got a game port, MIDI port there, and that connects to a joystick or any other MIDI interface device. Your video port connects a monitor to your computer, and there are a number of video ports and connector types. You've got the VGA. Anyone tells me what that stands for?
Let me guess, a lot of people have seen these TLAs and never knew what they stood for.
Hang on, we've got something there. Video graphics adapter, that's correct. Well done. Well, it's actually array, video graphics array.
I was actually going to be nice and not correct him, but yeah, it is video graphics array.
Yeah. And it's got a...
No, we're not going into MIDI, sorry, even if you are a musician. It's not covered.
Yeah, because there's a heap of those too.
There are, and I'd be looking up MIDI on Wikipedia, and you'll find that it's a serial standard that runs at 19,200 bits per second, and it'll tell you lots of other things. You can get a MIDI anything, just about, and we don't talk about it any more than that.
Okay, so yes, your VGA, it's got a 3-row 15-pin female connector, and gives you analog output to a monitor. You have DVI, which stands for Digital Visual Interface. It's got a 24-pin female connector. Sometimes has also a 29-pin female connector. It gives you compressed digital output to your monitor. Gives you, as it sounds, both digital and analog signals. But if we're talking DVID, it gives you only digital signals.
Now here's an interesting point. I was just going to point out here, because somebody explained this to me the other day. If you have DVI-D and you get one of those DVI to VGA converters and plug it into a DVI-D, it won't work, because the actual converters that convert from DVI to VGA use the analog pins in the DVI connector, and DVI-D connectors do not have the analog pins in them. You have been warned.
Okay, HDMI, anyone know what that stands for?
Isn't it like high definition media interface or something?
Yeah, you're very close. High definition multimedia interface, very close. It uses a 19-pin connector and gives you digital video, digital audio signals. We also have S-Video that has a 4-pin connector and gives you analog video signals. With component RGB that has 3 shielded cables, there's a red, green and blue, and it's got RCA jacks and gives you analog video signals.
There's actually 2 forms of S-Video. There's actually a 4-pin and a 7-pin, and a lot of the laptops have the 7-pin on them as well, but they're not mentioned in the notes.
Okay, just going on your input devices, anyone name me some input devices that you use on your computer?
Keyboard.
Keyboard, yeah.
Mouse,
yes. Scanner we got here, microphone. Yeah.
Joysticks.
Yeah, all those.
Microphone.
Yep. Yeah, doing well. Okay, and the newer type things like your biometrics. Anyone know what we mean, biometrics?
Fingerprint.
Those are really nice fingerprint readers.
Yeah, just those. Yeah, voice recognition is another one of biometrics. Another one that's used and being used more commonly is retinal scanning. So there's a number of the biometrics. That's correct. Okay. So yeah, there's a number of input devices, and I think we've mentioned many of them. And biometrics being one of the newer types of security devices. Yes. Okay.
Looks like I might have to shut the web server down. Our ping's up to 192.
Oh, wonderful. Okay. With your monitors and projectors, they are primary output devices. So they're obviously putting a signal or an image out. We have a number of different types of monitors. The CRT. Anyone tell me what CRT stands for? You thought I was going to be talking, didn't you? That's correct, yeah. Okay. They're the most, well, they were the most common, they're not so much common now. They have 3 electron beams in them, and they each gets focused to hit the phosphor on the screen, so it allows it to have a glow of either red, blue or green. The areas that don't get struck by the electron beam, they don't glow. So you've got like an area that's glowing and areas that are non-glowing. The LCD, anyone tell me what that stands for?
Liquid crystal display.
That's correct. We're seeing more and more LCD types of screens. Yep. With LCD you have 2 polarizing filters and they've got liquid crystal solution between them, now hence why they get called that. You have a current that aligns the crystals so that the actual light can either pass through or not pass through, as whichever the case may be. So when you have light passing through in certain areas and not in others, it gives you or creates an image. You've got the 2 forms of LCD. It comes in either active matrix or passive matrix. when we're talking about active matrix, it's sometimes referred to as thin film transistor or TFT. You've probably heard that. With TFT, it lets you have each pixel in a controlled way, so it gives you a nice sharp colour images. The passive matrix is less expensive, so doesn't give you the same sort of pristine type image. What was that, Jenny? Sorry? Yeah, no, that's right. The digital light processing is another technology that is available, and it's used in projectors. With a DLP projector, you would have a spinning colour wheel, and it's got a little microprocessor in it that's controlled array of mirrors. And it's called a digital micro mirror device, or DMD device. So you've got, in that particular type of projector, you have a mirror that corresponds to a specific pixel. And each of the mirrors reflects light toward or away from the projector optics. So you get a monochromatic image of up to 1,024 shades of grey that are actually in between white and black. What happens then is the colour wheel then puts in or adds colour, and it actually comes up then as a colour image. When we talk of monitor resolution, we talk in the way of pixels, and the higher the resolution settings, the better the image you're going to get. So when we talk pixels, we're talking an abbreviation for picture elements. So they're just little tiny dots that comprise a screen. So each of those pixels actually consists of red, green or blue. The dot pitch is the distance between the pixels on the screen. So the lower your dot pitch number produces a better image. Something else that's measured there is your refresh rate, and that's just how often per section the image is rebuilt. So the higher your refresh rate produces better image and reduces your level of flicker that happens. Also, things referred here are your interlace or non-interlace. So if you've got an interlace monitor, you get an image by scanning the screen twice. The first scan actually covers the odd lines top to bottom, the second scan covers the even lines. If you have a non-interlaced monitor, it gives you an image by scanning the screen, and it does it by one line at a top, from top to bottom. And if you're talking, most CRT monitors these days would be non-interlaced. Your horizontal vertical colours are the number of pixels in the line is referred to as your horizontal resolution. So the number of lines you've got in a screen is the vertical resolution, and the number of colours that you can actually get is the colour resolution. Another measurement that's used is the aspect ratio, and that's where you have a horizontal to vertical measurement of the viewing area of the monitor. For example, if you had a 4:3 aspect ratio, would apply to viewing an area that's like 16 inches by 12 inches. So an 4:3 aspect ratio would also apply to a viewing area that had a 24 inch by 18 inch high. There's more on aspect ratios in your notes if you want to do a little bit more study on those. With monitors, there's a number of things that you can set. Obviously, your brightness, your contrast, your position, or you can have a reset, which actually returns your monitor to its factory default settings. Printers are output devices. They give you hard copies of files that you send to the printer. And obviously, we've got specialised printers now that actually will give you colour printing or photo printing, good graphics, and often what you pay for it, the more you pay for it, the better you get. Not always, but as a rule of thumb. Your speakers and headphones, as we mentioned, are also output devices. Okay. With the computer, the system resources that we talk about, for communication between the CPU and the other components in the computer. So there are three types that of system resources. There are IRQs. Anyone tell me what that stands for?
Interrupt requests.
Thank you, Grace. Yes. You have input, output, or IO port addresses, and direct memory access, or DMA. So interrupt requests, they are used by your computer components, and they request, as they sound, information from the CPU. So the IRQ travels along a wire that's on your system board to the CPU, and the CPU says, hey, got a request here, and then it thinks about how it's going to fulfill that request. Now, does that fulfillment of the request by priority? So the priority of the request is determined by the IRQ number that's assigned to the particular component. Your computers these days have 16 IRQs, and they're numbered 0 to 15.
That's on a standard PC architecture, whereas with newer computers you have an APIC, or an Advanced Programmable Interrupt Controller, and they can often have 31 interrupts. However, you'll find that they are connected to the regular interrupt controller as well. So if you look at your interrupt assignments on a newer PC, you will also see that you can have a lot more devices. Otherwise, you have to share devices on various... various things. And David's just rocked up. There we go.
Yeah. we forgot to put our sign up. We're on lecture. Okay. No, that's okay. We forgot the sign this morning. Our fault. Okay, so the IO output input-output port addresses allow you to communicate between devices and also the software. They're used to send and receive data for each component, and each of the components is going to have a unique I/O port assigned. Something like 65,500 and something, I think it was 36. Oh, well, close, in a computer, and you find them referenced by hexadecimal addresses in the range, I think, from about 40H to FFFFH. And for those that haven't done hexadecimal, haven't done CCNA discovery, you'll have to learn a little bit about hexadecimal and decimal and binary as we go along. DMA channels are used by your high-speed devices, and they allow you to communicate with the main memory. They allow for each of the devices to actually bypass interaction with the CPU, and they allow it to store and retrieve information from memory.
Do not confuse ISA DMA with PCI DMA. ISA DMA, you've got DMA channels from 0 to 7, usually set with a jumper. PCI DMA is a completely different beastie altogether.
Okay, any questions? Because we're sort of at the end of today's lecture.
Yeah, I heard something about glass plasma displays. Can you brief if possible?
Sorry, you heard something about what? Sorry, I didn't quite catch that.
No, I didn't either. Can you repeat that question for us?
Yeah, I heard something about some glass plasma displays. Can you brief something about that?
Oh, plasma. Okay.
Glass plasma. I'd be tempted to say look it up on Wikipedia. I know that plasma isn't as popular as it once was, and it doesn't last as long as the liquid crystal displays, and that's why all the plasmas are becoming cheap, and I personally wouldn't be bothering with them. I'd go out and buy an LCD, although they tell me that laser technology is on the... flat panel displays are LCDs. And for the person that said they're not getting emails on Cavi Discuss, can you please email me after lecture and I will fix it on the list server if possible?
Up
Okay, I think we sent off an email.
Yep, no worries. Could be, are you subscribed with a Gmail address, Corey, or not?
Yeah, we've got a Gmail address. The announced stuff is all coming through. It's just the Cavi Discuss that isn't.
No idea why that is. Yes, Grace.
Okay, so a note on the Gmail, and if anyone knows how to fix this, this would be awesome. But if you send a message to a list, you will not get that message back in your inbox. So just so you, everybody who uses Gmail knows that, it probably went through. You just aren't getting it back.
It may see the fact that you've sent a message from yourself to caviinstructors@gots.net, and then it sees the message that comes back as a spam, perhaps.
No, it's just a thing that they do. They make it so that you don't get your own messages back. It's like that way by design, like, for some reason.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I'm on a couple of lists like that.
No, no, our list does send messages straight back to you. It's actually Gmail's fault, not the list servers.
Right, that's what I'm saying. It's totally for Gmail people, and that's what happened.
Yeah, no, absolutely. In fact, there's a checkbox that tells me whether I can check it to stop people from receiving the messages they send to the list, but I have not checked that box, so you should get your own message back. Unless you're using Gmail.
Okay, how about we have a little quiz?
Everybody get into their chat windows and ready to type their answers. We do not accept people speaking their answers.
Okay. All right, so how many FireWire devices can be supported by a single FireWire port? That's everyone we want to answer.
And if anybody knows, we'd like an answer from everyone. Of course, you've all pre-read these notes before the lecture, haven't you? Everybody's pre-read the Chapter 1 notes, yes? The whole chapter? Okay, just making sure, because next week we're going to have Chapter 2, so it's very important that you pre-read the notes before. Because we are going to ask you quiz questions that we didn't actually say the answers to, because that's the sort of nasty people we are. So very important you pre-read your notes.
And yeah, so how about a few more answers?
They don't know. The answer is 63.
Yes. Okay. Just bear with me a second. I'm just scrolling down.
How many pins in a SATA cable?
Oh, okay.
See, Geraldine, when they know the answer, they all answer, you see? You're all correct. There's seven.
All right, next question. Which type of memory transfers data twice as fast as SD-RAM and increases performance by transferring data at twice per cycle? Is it A, DDR SD-RAM? Is it B, DRAM 2? Is it C, D, SD-RAM? Or is it D, ROM?
Looks like my Ventrilo just crashed.
Oh, did it? Still getting it, it's just coming in. I'm just letting you finish. A mixed answer there. Correct. The correct answer is A.
I'm just going to stop recording in case I lose this lecture.
Okay, all right.